Yeah, despite this agreement that you did refer to there, of course, the U.S. has refused to apologize or to accept responsibility. Let's bring in Mr. Valletta now, the anti-war activist joining us from Virginia. Mr. Valletta, 3 years after the attack, Admiral William J. Crow, as you might know, admitted that the warship had been illegally traversing Iranian territorial waters when it launched the missile attack. And other reports said two separate U.S. warships in the area had also positively identified the aircraft as civilian. Isn't there enough evidence here to warrant a proper investigation or legal response?
Well, you're right. This should have been a different kind of investigation, an international investigation. And there's many facts that are argued back and forth between the various parties. But I think Mr. Lamb mentioned that at this point it is not denied by the U.S. that the Vincennes was in Iranian territorial waters. According to the reports at the time, particularly a very in-depth examination of the incident by the U.S. Newsweekly, Newsweek, the captain was aggressively seeking to engage in combat. He commanded the most advanced cruiser in the Aegis class cruiser in the United States Navy, and had never himself been in combat, and that of course is a prerequisite for moving up man to a higher rank, and he has a history of aggressively putting himself in situations that could have unnecessarily resulted in combat. The larger question is, what was the Vincennes doing in the Persian Gulf in the first place? This was at the end of the 8-year war between Iran and Iraq, in which the United States gave tactical and intelligence information to Saddam. At the same time, it hoped to prolong the war as long as possible in order to weaken both countries, which were seen as regional powers, and in the area where the United States government wanted to be the only regional power. So it makes sense that they wouldn't apologize, because that there were much bigger crimes in terms of their whole approach to relations with countries in the Middle East. As we're speaking, I'm watching Press TV on the internet, and I see that the day is being remembered with ceremonies in Iran and the dropping of flowers on the spot on the Gulf where the airliner went down. There are no similar no similar ceremonies taking place here in the United States. 2 years ago, on the 20th anniversary, the organization that I work with, called the Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality, did have a program here in Richmond that was covered by Press TV, in which at that time we formally apologized on behalf of the American people for this terrible loss of 290 lives, and we placed the blame squarely on the United States government and the United States military. I would like to just reiterate that for any of the Iranians who are listening today, that the people of the United States have no reason to feel hostile to the Iranian people or its government. And again, to the extent that it means anything more than just a symbolic gesture.
Okay, Mr. Valletta, you just referred there to the basic fact that the families of those victims, still a lot of questions for them unanswered and for much of the international community. Mr. Lamb, I'd like to bring you in here. What is hindering a judicial process for the families who are still looking for justice, so to speak?
Well, there was a settlement of the ICJ case, and the Islamic Republic agreed not to proceed on behalf of the families after that settlement, that financial settlement, was done. It doesn't mean that in light of new evidence, if it's garnered, that a case could be reopened or rebrought on another legal theory. The case could be brought up in the General Assembly, at least of the United Nations, or in any international forum. If the government, if the families decide to do that, there's, of course, also numerous theories of liability and litigation that could be brought possibly against certain individuals who were involved in that. But it's difficult, but it's not impossible, to reopen the case, at least in the public arena, or to seek out a court. But the United Nations is available, but I think that the International Court of Justice is foreclosed because of the wording of that agreement, where that was to be paid in full settlement of any outstanding claims. So that would have to be got around to proceed in certain legal systems.
Well, Mr. Lam, let's turn to the situation right now. 22 years on, with that case largely unresolved for many of the families of the victims, another major issue now is, of course, President Obama's approval of fresh sanctions against Tehran.
Yeah.
What is the U.S. trying to achieve with these sanctions?
You know, it's difficult to know. They have been so thoroughly discredited by almost every country now. I think Obama probably wants to forget about those sanctions, but yet under pressure of the coming elections, under pressure of the Congress, he'll probably continue to go along that path. But the problem for him is, besides the Zionist lobby after him, is that he's got to find a policy that makes sense, that has some credibility. Now with the debacle being exposed again in Afghanistan, I think that's the problem. The Americans have got to come up with a credible policy, a way to disengage and leave the Middle East. And that's his problem. He doesn't want to do that, of course, because of the resources and pressure from Israel. But it is very clear, I think, to most people, or increasingly to most people, that there's no viable policy. And unless there's a major change, which includes real dialogue and getting off this subject of harassing Iran, there are many happy days ahead for the American policy in the Middle East.
Okay, Mr. Phil Villeta, Obama has talked about being alongside the Iranian people, but now a lot of critics, including the CEO of Total, for instance, say the embargo on petrol products is going to harm ordinary Iranians. Why should Iranian people be targeted?
Well, they shouldn't be. The sanctions are always going to hurt the public at large. You can't isolate the effect of the sanctions like you can't laser surgery or something. And don't forget the United States has had sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran since 1979. And there's now four separate sets of sanctions that the U.S. has pressed the United Nations to impose. I think one of the lessons to keep in mind from the tragedy of 1988 is that when an incredibly powerful country like the United States allows itself to get whipped up into a frenzy over a perceived threat by a country that, in Iran's case, hasn't attacked anyone in over 200 years, there's a tremendous potential for disaster. And just as the shooting down of Airbus 655 was a totally unnecessary act, a confrontation between the United States and Iran would also make no sense whatsoever. But we live in dangerous times, and I think it behooves all of us, particularly those in the United States, to remind constantly the U.S. public the true history of U.S. relations with Iran, and including the Airbus disaster downing, which really amounts to criminal murder of July 8th, 1988.
Okay, I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this part of the program. A big thank you to both our guests, international lawyer Franklin Lam from Beirut and Phil Villeta, anti-war activist and editor of the Virginia Defender from Richmond in Virginia.